It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up today on Food Friday, we'll talk to the author of the new cookbook, Mother Grains, Recipes for the Grain Revolution. First, a man was charged with a hate crime this week for allegedly attacking a transgender couple in La Crosse and using anti-gay slurs. Wisconsin's hate crime statute doesn't include protections on the basis of gender identity. That's not unique. Just under half of states have a hate crime law on the books that includes gender identity as a protected class. We're talking about the hate crime allegations against a La Crosse man and hate crime laws in Wisconsin and around the country. And you could join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions about hate crime laws and how they work. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Hope Kerwin is a reporter for WPR based in La Crosse. Hope, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Before we get to the hate crime part of this story, can you tell us about the alleged assault that's at the center of the story?
Yeah, so the criminal complaint says that Travis Crawford approached a teen couple in a public park on Tuesday, July 20th. It says that he started yelling at them, accused them of having sex in the park, and called them an anti-gay slur. When one of the teens told Crawford to go away, he then punched the boy in the face and started kicking him while he was on the ground. And the complaint does identify the victim of that physical assault as both a juvenile and as a transgender boy, and it identifies his girlfriend as transgender as well.
There are assault charges being filed in this case, but what got a lot of attention was whether or not hate crime charges could be added to that. Initially, no. Can you talk about the back and forth on whether hate crime charges could or would be filed?
Yeah, so there was some discussion on this issue when La Crosse Mayor Mitch Reynolds, came out with a public statement saying that, state hate crime statute does not include gender identity as a protected class, as you said. Well, I spoke with Deputy District Attorney in La Crosse today, and she said that they had originally considered hate crime, the hate crime enhancement, but wanted to gather more facts in the case, which is why they initially filed felony battery charges, but did not include that enhancement. She said after reviewing the facts of the case, speaking with the victims, and they were able to gather enough evidence that they felt confident they could prove that in this case, that Crawford allegedly attacked the teens based on his perception of their sexual orientation. He thought that they were gay based on his use of homophobic language. And so obviously it's important to remember that the charges in this case are just alleged at this point. It has not gone to court. But she says that's why they decided to go back and add the hate crime enhancer. And she says it's not unusual for them to amend charges after reviewing the case further.
And to be clear, though, it's because of anti-gay slurs being used in this case, which would be covered under the state's hate crime laws, not because of the transgender identity of the victims of the alleged attacks, which was not covered under hate crimes laws. Am I following this right, Hope?
Exactly. She reminded me that it's when it comes to the hate crime enhancement, it's about the attacker's motivation. It's about their perception, of the person rather than the actual identity of the person themselves. And so because they feel that they have evidence that Crawford's motivation was based on his perception of the two teens' sexual orientation, which is a protected characteristic under state hate crime laws, that they were able to pursue this enhancement.
And you had mentioned, Hope, local officials talking about this issue and hoping that the legislature will tackle this issue. What are they hoping the state would change in its hate crimes laws?
Yeah, so La Crosse Mayor Mitch Reynolds, I spoke with him today about this addition of the hate crime enhancement. He said, while he was pleased to see that it doesn't let state lawmakers off the hook in this case, that, he felt that there really needed to be explicit language to protect people based on their gender identity. LGBTQ groups in La Crosse as well as across the state have also, called for similar action, saying that gender identity and gender expression should be protected under state hate crime statutes. So, that call has not been addressed.
Hope, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Happy to do it.
Hope Kerwin is a reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio based in La Crosse. She told us about hate crime charges against a man who allegedly attacked a transgender couple while using anti-gay slurs in La Crosse. Now let's take a look at hate crime statutes in Wisconsin and around the United States. There are federal hate crime laws in place, but at the state level, there are a lot of differences from one state to another in terms of what these laws do and don't cover, and some states don't have their own hate crime laws at all. Melissa Michelson joins us now. She's Dean of Arts and Science and a professor of political science at Menlo College in California. She's an expert on LGBTQ rights. Melissa, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Happy to be here.
How common is it for states to have specific hate crime laws related to transgender identity?
It's not. One of the great mismatches in the protections of LGBTQ rights is that while a lot of folks think there should be protections, including anti-slur hate crime legislation, in most states and at the federal level, there really aren't those sorts of protections in place.
Now, in this case, it was kind of a strange borderline thing where the victims of this alleged attack in La Crosse are transgender youth, but the attacker used anti-gay slurs, which prosecutors are saying does mean the state's hate crimes law does apply here. Do we see this kind of weird gray area blurring in cases like this often?
I think the more important takeaway from this actually is how the umbrella consideration of LGBTQ does cover gender expression. And the reason that it's an umbrella classification is that they share, all members of this community share that they challenge assumptions about gender presentation and gender role. And so while we might try to make these more solid distinctions between, well, these people, it's a sexual orientation identity, and these people, it's a gender identity, really what we're talking about is people who challenge gender norms. And that's the reason that they've come together. That's the reason, as y'all just mentioned, that advocacy organizations are saying you have to protect gender identity and gender presentation, gender expression in these laws. So it's not very common that the law is protected, but I think we're moving in that direction, and particularly in the light of the Bostock decision from the Supreme Court.
Can you talk about that decision and why it may be affecting what states are doing?
Sure. So folks might remember that this was a case where the Supreme Court decision written by Neil Gorsuch said that people who are members of a sexual orientation minority or a gender identity minority are all protected by the Civil Rights Act of 1965 because the ways in which they all need protection are from violations of what is expected of them based on their sex. And so even though the Civil Rights Act of 1965 only specifically mentions protections against discrimination based on sex, that implies and thus gives constitutional coverage to violations of people's rights based on their sexual orientation or gender identity. And the cases that were considered were specifically about gay people and transgender people. And so what this means is that the Supreme Court is saying laws that protect against sex discrimination also cover LGBTQ people. And so logically, that's going to trickle down to the state level in Wisconsin, to the local level in places like La Crosse, to say, well, if sex discrimination is illegal, and if we allow for protections of those rights, then logically, we also have to use those laws to protect members of the LGBTQ community.
So if I'm hearing you right, does that mean that Wisconsin's current hate crime law, which is not does not specify transgender identity, could it be used under that interpretation without being changed by the state legislature to protect transgender individuals?
Well, I think what advocacy groups don't want to see is that you'd have to take this all the way to the Supreme Court or to a district court to confirm that that's how they're going to be interpreting the laws in light of Bostock. And so I do think it offers, I do think it offers better protection and more immediate protection for folks if the legislation is changed. And I would add that part of what we saw in this case and what we often see in these cases is that individuals don't always call the police, right? Or are concerned about calling the police if they're members of an LGBTQ community because they don't think they'll be taken seriously, because they don't think hate crime extensions will be added to the battery charges. And so if the legislature acts and extends the law, that's sending a signal that, yes, we do care about transgender and gender nonconforming people, and you are protected, and we don't allow for hate crimes against members of this community. So it's an important signal to the community that their rights are going to be protected, and it's going to mean that they're going to be more often to contact law enforcement when something happens. And so it protects everybody better and more immediately if the legislature acts.
We're talking to Melissa Michelson, Dean of Arts and Science and a professor of political science at Menlo College. She's talking to us about hate crime laws across the country, especially as they relate to sexual orientation and gender identity. You can join in, not, by the way, at our usual 800 number. Apparently there's a problem with that. Here is a substitute number for you. Ready? 608-890-3452. That's 608-890-3452. Do you think Wisconsin's hate crimes laws should specifically include gender identity? What do you want to know about laws protecting LGBTQ people in Wisconsin and across the U.S., especially when it comes to these hate crime enhancers in cases like this alleged assault in La Crosse? Call in at 608-890-3452. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk now with Melissa Michelson, Dean of Arts and Science and Professor of Political Science at Menlo College. We're talking about why hate crime laws are different in states around the country and why many of them don't include protection based on gender identity. An issue here in Wisconsin with an alleged assault in La Crosse last week. You can join in with your thoughts, your questions about how this all works at a temporary number, 608-890-3452. That's 608-890-3452, or email ideas@wpr.org. Melissa, can you tell us a little bit about the history of hate crimes enhancers, especially as they apply to LGBTQ people around the country?
Well, we really haven't had a lot of protections for LGBTQ people. And that only happened recently in the wake of the Matthew Shepard case, which folks might be familiar with. And so when that young man was tied to a fence and assaulted and left to die, there was a national uproar that a young gay man had been abused and killed in that way. And then there was an assault against a Black man, James Byrd. And so now we have the Matthew Shepard and James Byrd hate crime law on the books, but that has only been a law at the federal level for a couple of decades. It's really been a pretty recent phenomenon where people are taking these sorts of hate crimes seriously. And of course, there's an ongoing debate about whether or not we should be enhancing penalties for crimes based on what people say or what people think, or whether crimes should just be about what people do and about the battery or the assault that they're perpetrating and not necessarily why. And so obviously the tide has been shifting recently where we are having more and more hate crime enhancements for this sort of behavior as a way of messaging that it's not okay. But it's really not very widespread and very recent that that has been happening.
Let's bring on a caller now at 608-890-3452. Dave is with us in Toma. Dave, hi.
Yeah, hi. I wanted to say I think these enhancement laws are ridiculous. Does that mean if somebody that likes us beats us up, it's okay? I mean, the law is not being applied evenly to everybody. Why is one group more important than another? It's kind of ridiculous.
Dave, thanks a lot for the call. And Melissa, you just alluded to that debate. Can you talk about the reasoning behind the existence of hate crime laws? As I understand it, originally post-Civil War and civil rights era, the idea was if you're targeting people to prevent their participation in public life, from voting, for example, because of their category, that's where the hate crimes kick in. Can you tell us a little more about that?
Right. So the idea behind hate crime enhancements is that when you're perpetrating a hate crime, you're attacking a whole community and silencing a whole community. And so, for example, when the Klan burned burns a cross on a Black family's lawn, it's not just a crime against that family, it's a crime against the whole Black community, because it is saying to them, you're not welcome here and you are in danger. So don't try to exercise your civil rights. And similarly, when there are hate crimes perpetrated against members of the LGBTQ community, it is not just that individual or that couple that's being attacked, it's an attack on the whole community. So that's why we have those hate crime enhancements. It's because those hate crimes are different than quote unquote regular assaults, or, you know, an assault by somebody who likes you or isn't necessarily biased against you because of your identity. It's silencing and it's violence against the whole broader community of people.
Dave, thanks a lot for calling in at our temporary number, 608-890-3452. That's 608-890-3452. Talk about hate crime laws, especially as they apply to on the basis of sexual orientation or gender identity, after a case that brought those issues up here in Wisconsin. Melissa Michelson is with us, Dean of Arts and Science and Professor of Political Science at Menlo College in California. Still time for your calls with questions or your thoughts at 608-890-3452. Melissa, when a state has a hate crimes enhancer law, or at the federal level, do we see them being applied pretty consistently from jurisdiction to jurisdiction, or does it really depend on, say, who's prosecuting the case?
Yeah, you pretty much hit the nail on the head there. There's a lot of inconsistency in the ways that these laws are applied and in the ways that the data are reported, which is another way that the federal government has changed the way we respond to hate crimes in recent years. Some states, for example, Alabama, apparently has had zero hate crimes against LGBTQ people in recent years. And, you know, logic just tells me that that's unlikely. It's just that they're going unreported. And so it's not just that there's inconsistency in the way that the laws are applied, but again, that there's inconsistency in reporting because of perceptions of the degree to which people will be taken seriously, or that they'll face further harassment and dehumanization from law enforcement. And so it really does depend on the local context and the degree to which local law enforcement or state law enforcement officials and lawyers are going to take seriously that hate crimes are a problem that terrorizes a community.
Is there any kind of effort to get consistency among the many, many, say, police jurisdictions around this country to say, here's how we're hoping you're going to handle potential hate crimes. Here's how we're hoping you're going to report it to the federal government, even if it's not prosecuted, so we can track these things?
Yeah, there are laws on the books that request that all law enforcement jurisdictions around the country report their data, but it is not required. And of course, even if it's required that they report what they have, again, many people are just not reporting. And so that's why I think it does come down to the state and local level, where if you do have these laws on the books that very specifically say, we're taking these sorts of hate crimes against the LGBTQ community seriously, then that signals, right, to people that they should report, signals to law enforcement that they should be keeping those statistics and reporting them. But you can't just impose that at the federal level and expect everyone around the country to decide that, okay, we are now going to take this seriously and we're concerned about this violence. The truth is, violence against transgender and gender nonconforming people is pretty rampant. And even the statistics that we do have show that reports are increasing. And so while we may be making advances in terms of acceptance of same-sex marriage, we are still pretty far away from acceptance of the idea that there is a gender continuum and that transgender, non-binary, genderqueer people are a real thing and not something to fear or something to deny.
You mentioned that hate crimes enhancers on the basis of sexual orientation is itself pretty recent and spread through many states in the country pretty quickly. Do you sense any sort of beginning momentum when it comes to gender identity?
There's definitely been a push for that in the advocacy community and in some of the more blue or more progressive parts of the country, especially in the wake of the Obergefell decision. So now the attention has turned to transgender rights. But of course, you know that at the same time, we've really seen a backlash in many parts of the country and attacks on transgender people, on transgender youth playing in sports, and specifically, and also on medical care for transgender youth. And so it's become yet another polarizing issue where on one side, we have people who want to allow transgender people to live openly, to participate in sports, to get the medical care that they need. And then on the other side, folks who are continuing to deny transgender people their humanity and to try to exclude them from these everyday activities like getting medical care and playing sports.
In our last minute or so, Melissa, what are you watching? Where are your eyes turned now when it comes to protections for transgender people? State legislatures, federal government, the courts? What's foremost in your mind right now?
What I'm looking at right now is what's happening at the state level. As I just mentioned, there's really been a flurry of laws at the state level trying to take away rights from transgender youth in healthcare and in sports. And all over the country, they're solving a problem that doesn't exist, right? They're banning transgender youth from sports, allegedly to protect girls from unfair competition from youth that they see as biologically male, and really hurting youth, especially given that there is no problem to fix, and all it's doing is telling transgender youth that they're not valued, that their feelings don't matter, and that there's something wrong with them. And then at the same time, we've got all these state laws now taking away access to care, access to hormones, access to the kinds of things that keep transgender youth safe, because the number one risk to transgender people is mental health and suicidal ideation and depression that leads them to do things that are dangerous to themselves, including abusing drugs and alcohol. What we need to keep our youth in this country safe is to give them access to healthcare and to accept them for who they are, not try to make them think that they're a monster, that there's something wrong with them. And I mean, if we care about the lives of these young people, we've got to push back.
And we'll leave it there. Thanks to Melissa Michelson from Menlo College. Coming up, it's this week's edition of Food Friday. We're baking with all variety of grains. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up Monday at 7:30 on The Morning Show, a doctor with the Wisconsin Medical Society joins the show to talk about the society's call for people to get vaccinated against COVID-19. That's Monday morning at 7:30 here on the Ideas Network. Now it's Food Friday, and our guest wants you to think beyond the common enriched refined white flour we use in a lot of our cooking and baking and embrace the world of ancient grains. She includes 8 of them in her new cookbook covering barley, buckwheat, corn, oats, rice, rye, sorghum, and yeah, wheat. These grains can bring depth of flavor and texture, even some health benefits to your baking. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Are any of those household words in your kitchen? Do you embrace some of these grains in your own cooking? Do you have a go-to recipe that uses the buckwheat, barley, oats, whatever it might be? Are you a fan of Wisconsin sorghum flour? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Wait, do we have that number up yet? No, we've got to use this different number. Ready? 608-890-3452. That's 608-890-3452. Our 800 number is down for the count for the moment. I'll keep you posted. Roxana Julipot is head baker and owner of Friends and Family Bakery in Los Angeles. Her new cookbook is called Mother Grains, Recipes for the Grain Revolution. Roxana, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, looking at your book, I can tell you love these different grains. What got you so interested in cooking with this variety of grains?
Well, my enthusiasm first started with seasonal things, you know, all kinds of fruits and herbs and produce, because we have such abundance of all of those things almost year-round here in California. And in time, it became very obvious to me that grains fit that profile. They are also seasonal. They are definitely agriculture, and they can reflect the rhythms of the year, depending on how and when you use them. And they are incredibly interesting as far as flavor and texture and history.
One thing I love about this group of grains you suggest cooking with is it looks to me like it doesn't have to be particularly expensive and it doesn't have to be particularly complicated, right?
Absolutely not. All you have to be is just a little bit more curious.
I can do that. Now, ancient grains, what do you mean by that phrase?
Well, the terminology gained speed recently because we started to trace back all the seeds over time. And this applied to all of agriculture, not just grains. And we can definitely establish an origin of a lot of these seeds and determine that they have been living among us, among humans, for millennia. And a lot of these seeds have changed over time because they have been adapted, whether by natural methods or by intervention of us humans, whether it's in a lab to create GMOs or like more traditionally grafting techniques that we do over long periods of time. And somewhere along the line, we created new varietals and new species. The species itself started to sort of evolve, just like us humans and many other species in the plant and mammal kingdom. And what ended up happening is that we could identify these ones that prevail, that kind of like survive all this period of transformation and evolution. So those are really, they are literally ancient seeds that are still with us.
We are baking with Roxana Julepot on this edition of Food Friday. Her new cookbook is called Mother Grains, Recipes for the Grain Revolution. She says we can do a lot with a wide variety of grains in our baking and pancaking and more. You can join in if you use grains kind of outside of the box for our normal cooking. Or if you have a question, 608-890-3452 is the number to call today. 608-890-3452 or post the Ideas Network Facebook page. Roxana, you shared some recipes with us, and I love that you started us off with a classic that we could try different grains in, chocolate chip cookies, which I love, and your base recipe uses sorghum, which we grow here in Wisconsin. Tell us about this twist on the chocolate chip cookie.
Well, I realized that I was going to have to use some heavy convincing techniques to bring people along in this grain adventure, and it seemed to me that illustrating that we can make time-honored, celebrated goods that we make all the time, and just changing the flour could really have an impact on demonstrating my theory that grains can't just really permeate our baking and our cooking every single day.
All right. And so talk about sorghum in a chocolate chip cookie. When I'm tasting it, and I will, am I going to notice the difference because I use sorghum instead of flour, or like white flour?
Oh, that's awesome. Well, you know, the cool thing about sorghum and the reason why I think it has gained a little bit of popularity recently is because it is 100% wheat-free or gluten-free, right? So what that helps us do is bake for folks that are having issues consuming gluten or have a little bit of intolerance with when exposed to wheat. So it has an incredible value for us to be, you know, to bake for that population. But, you know, if we were to like leave all dietary restrictions aside and just think about what sorghum does to the cookie, you could actually blend it with a little bit of all-purpose flour just to gain this like amazing chewiness and a little bit of nuttiness. It has also a really good sort of natural sweetness to it. And it makes a really pretty looking cookie also, which cool. I think is important.
And then your chocolate chip cookie is this sort of tapestry that you can weave in a whole bunch of different grains. You then offer substitutions. If you don't want to do the sorghum, you could try most of the other grains in your book.
Right.
And a lot of them work with the chocolate chip cookie.
100%. And what I wanted to sort of point out is that this is just 8 examples. You could discuss the limit. Like, you can definitely try this with other things. The one grain that I thought wasn't very successful was cornmeal in this recipe. But that's fine. You know, cornmeal has so many other benefits, and it's so equally and incredibly delicious that we don't have to make cookies with it. But one of my favorites is actually rye. Rye flour is so versatile, a lot more than we think. And it pairs beautifully with chocolate. So this is a total winner. And that is the version that we make here at Friends and Family, our bakery here in Los Angeles.
Okay, but I don't want to leave corn out of our conversation because you write that corn is one that you grew up with in a lot of forms. Can you talk about the versatility of corn and cornmeal in our baking?
Right. So my heritage is actually Costa Rican on my father's side. So I did grew up eating tortillas and tamales and all kinds of other items made with nixtamalized corn. And then when I moved to the United States, I saw a prevalence of corn that is just ground straight from the corn kernels into cornmeal, and, you know, discovered the world of cornbread and corn muffins and all these other delicious things that are so deeply American. So my love for corn was deeply reinforced. So corn is as American as apple pie. It really is like the one grain that is endemic of our area, of our entire continent. It has also been interpreted and manipulated by many, many subcultures of the Americas. So the sky's the limit. When I was writing Mother Grains, at times I felt that I could write a book called Mother Corn. That's how huge the world of corn is.
And you gave us a recipe with the corn. It's a white cheddar cornmeal biscuit recipe. Can you tell us a little bit about that one?
Yeah, so the cornmeal makers or millers of the world are have a lot of possibilities when it comes to creating corn products. So cornmeal comes in different size of grind, you know, and that's really, it just referred to the size of the particle size of the grind. When we say coarse, it's just a little thicker. When we say fine, it's just a little bit finer. Then there's what we call corn flour, which is like even finer. And I like to use sort of like the smaller size of cornmeal when we make this biscuit. However, it is really delicious with coarse cornmeal as well. And what makes it special is just a little toothier, you know? And if that's something you enjoy, you can definitely use coarser cornmeal. The one thing that I do is like I do blend it with a little bit of white refined flour, all-purpose flour, mm-hmm. just to make it more supple and add that structure that the corn doesn't have because it is, in fact, a gluten-free flour.
We're talking to Roxana Julepot. She's the head baker and owner of Friends and Family Bakery in Los Angeles and a grain advocate. Her new cookbook is called Mother Grains, Recipes for the Grain Revolution. You can join in at our temporary number, 608-890-3452. That's 608-890-3452. What questions do you have about using some of these different grains we're talking about? Do you have a favorite from this list? The buckwheat, the barley, the sorghum, rice flour, maybe you name it, rye, oat. Call in now at 608-890-3452. That's 608-890-3452 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk now with Roxana Julepot, head baker and owner of Friends and Family Bakery in Los Angeles, focusing on local and ancient grains. Her new cookbook is called Mother Grains, Recipes for the Grain Revolution. She says we can make great foods with great textures, flavors when we bake with a variety of grains. And we want to hear from you at 608-890-3452. Do you like to experiment and use different kinds of flours, for example, in your baking? What is your favorite? How about pancakes? Do you mix things up with the flours in there? Call 608-890-3452 with your questions or experiences. That's 608-890-3452 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Roxana, we got an email from Grant who wonders if you have suggestions for a method of sprouting whole grain berries. Grant wants to use them for sourdough bread baking, apparently. Do you have some thoughts for Grant?
Absolutely. Grant, this is one of my favorite things to do, and it's actually quite easy and not as contrived as we might think. I definitely include a method in Mother Grains because I use it for a couple of the breads that I make with rye, which is one of the most fun grains to sprout because it's actually really beautiful. So you want to get really nice berries that have not stuff that you found sitting in your garage 3 years later. You definitely want to make sure that there's a level of freshness and that perhaps the seed itself hasn't been compromised, meaning that it hasn't been contaminated perhaps or anything like that. It has just been like fresh from a farm and maybe sitting in your pantry. So what you will do is like you'll take the grain and the grains themselves, the kernels, and you're going to find a really good size container. I like to use a 1-quart container for about 1 cup of berries. The next thing you're going to do is you're going to go ahead and pour cold water over them. Let them soak for about 5 minutes and you're going to drain them entirely over the kitchen sink. Those grains are going to go into that container, that 1-quart container, and you're going to put a lid on it. Ideally, you would be able to poke holes on the lid, whether it because it's a mason jar that you can poke a few holes or a plastic lid, or you could even use a little bit of cheesecloth that you just wrap around the mouth of the container, maybe with a rubber band. The next day, you're going to repeat the same process. Soak for 5 minutes, drain back into the container, cover. The next day, you should have sprouts already. Now, here in the summer in California, last time I did this about a week ago, the sprouts were crazy. They became almost grass within just like 2 to 3 days, right? So once you see the protruding little, kind of like a little bit of a sprout coming, but peeking through, you can put them in the refrigerator, and that would slow down the germination process. You can wait 1 or 2 days before baking, but do realize that they will continue to sprout further, so they will get you will get grass just like I did if you don't use them quickly enough. And by the way, all of this happens at room temperature. Those first few days will happen at room temperature.
Hope that helps. Grant, do you have a question about how to use and bake with different kinds of grains or a favorite one yourself? You can ask our guest, Roxana Julepot, author of the new book, Mother Grains, Recipes for the Grain Revolution. You can call in now at 608-890-3452. That's 608-890-3452 or email ideas@WPR.org. Okay. Recipe time again. I love pancakes. I used to use a lot of different grains in my pancakes. Then along came kids. I had to tone it down a little bit. I could sneak in some wheat flour. Kids are going to be at college a month from today, so I can start making cool pancakes again. You gave us some baked buckwheat pancakes with berry compote. Tell us about this. It's buckwheat, and it ends up being baked, Roxana.
Right. So the cool thing about this pancake is that I love the idea that you can just make one giant pancake rather than make a stock of pancakes, especially when you're not baking or cooking for a large group of people now that your kids are leaving the house. So it's kind of like a perfect lazy Sunday morning breakfast. You can make a very simple pancake batter. I do use about 50% buckwheat flour to 50% all-purpose flour. However, do keep in mind that it does work with just buckwheat flour. I add the all-purpose for a little bit of balance and just to make it safe to flip because that gluten really helps with those maneuvers, right? And what's really, really cool about this technique is that because you start the pancake on the stove like as you would a traditional pancake, you get a really nice crusty situation right at the bottom. And then when you put it in the oven, you get what we call oven spring. And it's that sort of lift in the middle that makes it really nice and cakey. And then we flip again to get color on the other side. So by the time this pancake is ready, you have the best of both worlds, like really good texture caramelization on the outside and really, really tender center in the middle.
That's buckwheat. I know I've mixed in some cornmeal over the years, a blue cornmeal too. What else works well in our pancake mixes?
Absolutely everything. You know, I used to, I definitely use a couple of recipes to test the flavor and dimension and potential of each flour that I encounter using my chocolate chip cookie, because I know it so well. I can predict how it's going to behave. And then the new flour just has the time to shine because I've controlled all the other variants, right? But pancake is also a really, really great way to discover grain. First, because it's a very low investment of time and product, and the results are quite immediate. So, for example, I was just in Chicago yesterday, and I came back with a flour from this farm or mill called Morning Glory Grains from Winnetka, Illinois. And that's exactly what I'm going to do. Tomorrow morning, this soft red winter wheat flour will become a pancake. And there's very little room for error because, you know, pancakes are a very loose formula. And you can always, if the flour seems like it's too briny, perhaps our pancake is going to be a little bit drier, right? Because that's what bran does. It absorbs a lot of liquid. So all I have to do is add a teeny bit more buttermilk. So it's definitely an ideal recipe for improvisation.
Suppose we want to level up, not just buy the flour off the shelf, which is what I would do, but we want to grind our own. You talk about that in the book. How big a deal is that to do?
Well, you know, it all depends on where you're at in your grain journey, right? Some of us really, really enjoy the process from, like we say, from the field to the cake, right? And every single sort of stop along the way. So this is cool to do. And especially if you live in an area where there's a high density of grain growers, that's definitely an interesting pursuit, because a lot of grain growers don't actually mill flour. They just sell the seed. And then a home countertop mill can give you a lot more possibilities. So there's just a couple of things you have to do and learn how to do. It's as easy as operating a coffee grinder, perhaps, or even a food processor. However, one thing that we always want to preserve when we're milling wheat is sort of to make sure that it's happening in a coldish environment, that the grain doesn't warm up too much, because grains, actually, we don't realize, but have a high content of fat, or high-ish, right? And when we heat up the grain through that milling process, we could create a situation in which the grain or the fats in the grain can become rancid. And then we have a shorter shelf life. So a really cool and easy tip would be to store your seeds in the freezer and grind from frozen, which they don't really stay frozen for very long. But that just kind of buys you a little bit more time and prevents the grain from overheating in the mill. There's a couple of options. They range in prices from like $100 to $400. And they produce really, really decent flour.
Right. And we'll leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Roxana Julepot, head baker and owner of Friends and Family Bakery in Los Angeles. We've been talking about her new cookbook. It's called Mother Grains, Recipes for the Grain Revolution. She shared a few recipes. We've got them up at WPR.org/Food Friday, a baked buckwheat pancake with berry compote, white cheddar cornmeal biscuits, and a chocolate chip cookie recipe, this one with sorghum, Wisconsin's own. Check them out. Let me know how they go. Coming up Monday on Central Time, Wisconsin prisons and jails saw big COVID outbreaks and big changes to protect staff and inmates. Some of those changes may stick around after the pandemic. We'll look at the post-COVID future of incarceration in the state. NPR science correspondent Joe Palka shares his pandemic project, finding rare and unusual words in the Oxford English Dictionary and bringing them back into the public eye. And here's a challenge for map makers, the whole universe in 3D. We'll check out a major scientific effort to paint a picture of the cosmos. That and more, it's all coming up Monday here on Central Time. sometimes when you go on the internet and follow a rabbit hole, it can take you to bad places. But sometimes it can lead to amazing insights about the world. And that happened to me today. I'll take it one step at a time. We're doing a conversation on Monday about HIPAA, the health information law. So, of course, I started singing Hungry Hungry HIPAA to the tune of the old TV commercial for the game Hungry Hungry Hippos. So I looked that up on YouTube. If you want to win the game, you gotta take good aim and get the most marbles with your hippo. Playing Hungry Hungry Hippos. Hungry Hungry Hippos. It's a catchy song. I heard it as a kid, and it still pops into my head in my adult life. But in the comments on that YouTube post, someone revealed a fact about that song that I didn't believe at first. But I checked it out, and it's true. The same guy who sang the Hungry Hungry Hippo song we just heard also sang this. Yes, the Hungry Hungry Hippos guy is also the Turnaround Bright Eyes guy from Total Eclipse of the Heart by Bonnie Tyler, which has stood the test of time as one of the weirdest music videos ever released. One singer, two icons of my youth. The singer's Rory Dodd from Canada. He's backed up Lou Reed, Barbara Streisand, and more. Two of his performances will live in my head forever. Turn around, Hungry Hippos, it's Central Time.